Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The holidays aren't just a time for Santa and twinkling lights. They're a time for travel and gatherings and party planning and hectic shopping. And if you're not careful, they can be a recipe for mental stress and even physical illness. So this hour, we hear about how to minimize the stress you may experience and how to spot in yourself and others the depression that often sets in at holiday time. That's later in the hour, but we start with how to keep yourself physically healthy during the cold and flu season that coincides with this time of year and at a time when viruses are taking hold, not just the flu, but mpox, measles, pertussis, even whooping cough. We haven't had to think much about those diseases until recently, as vaccine reluctance set in and as public policy at the federal level has turned its back on science and embraced theories that put us all in danger. And that is where we start our hour, looking at staying healthy for the holidays with Mecklenburg County's Public Health Director, Dr. Maynard Washington. Welcome back, Doctor. Welcome. Nice to see you again.
Great to be here.
So let's start with a county health checkup. You were on this program not too long ago, in October sometime, to talk about the measles outbreak that was going on at the time in Spartanburg County, South Carolina, and elsewhere around the country. And despite our proximity to that part of the upstate of South Carolina, we were not yet experiencing any terribly ill effects. Is that still the case?
That is still the case. We have no cases, known cases of measles here in Mecklenburg County among our residents or in North Carolina. But the outbreak in Spartanburg continues to grow, unfortunately.
How do you explain that we haven't had any spread? We've been through a Thanksgiving holiday where people certainly visited each other, and we have a number of people here who have relatives there and vice versa. And now we're about to approach the Christmas and New Year's holiday. How do you explain that there's been no cross-migration?
Well, I mean, certainly that's just a matter of, really chance, to be honest. So I think the reality is that, as the outbreak continues to grow in Spartanburg and beyond, certainly the risk of exposure among our residents is increasing. That being said, our partners in public health in South Carolina are doing their job. They're working to make sure that people are quarantining, that cases are being identified quickly. And of course, they're making vaccines available to residents on the ground to try to contain the outbreak.
So back in October, it appeared that the public health officials had contained the outbreak in South Carolina. And I'm hearing from you that continues. But you also recently said, if I read this correctly, you warned that the infection there could spread here. Why? What has changed?
Well, I think the reality is the outbreak continues to accelerate. So we're seeing more cases being diagnosed on a weekly basis than they had been at any point yet in the outbreak, which means that we're still seeing pretty active transmission in the community there. And so, again, as that continues to go up until that activity starts to go down, I think as it goes up, more people are potentially at risk.
Measles, I'm told, is highly contagious. In fact, I heard one health official on television news the other day say it's the most contagious of the viruses that we commonly see. What makes it so, and how is it spread?
It's super contagious. It's spread through respiratory droplets, and so it makes it very easy to transmit. It's a highly effective virus, and so it's able to transmit. One person can infect a large number of people pretty quickly, and so that's the risk that we certainly worry about, particularly if we are in communities or neighborhoods or schools or childcare centers that have a large number of children who are not up to date on vaccine.
People who aren't yet showing any visible signs of measles, and measles produce a rash on your face, on your hands, on your arms and legs, your trunk, even inside your mouth, I'm told. But it can take days for that rash to appear. In the meantime, are there other signs that you may be getting the measles or have the measles and are starting to feel the effects? Are there other signs other than the rash?
Sure. The common symptoms are pretty much similar to the flu syndrome. So, fever or hives or other kinds of sort of like feeling unwell, fatigue. You might expect some symptoms like that. Of course, this time of year, particularly in kids, those symptoms are pretty common with the flu and RSV and the common cold going around. So certainly it can be difficult to distinguish what it might be, which of course is probably challenging our colleagues down in South Carolina as they're navigating through the outbreak.
And at what point do you become contagious? Even if you haven't got the rash, if you've got the fever or the chills or the runny nose, are you able to spread it?
Yes, yeah. So you can, before the rash, people are thought to still be have measles virus in their respiratory droplets, even if the rash has not developed as comprehensively, as meaning it's all over their body. So it's certainly a risk still.
Okay. And if you've had the measles in the past, or if you've been vaccinated for measles, can you still become a carrier? If you're exposed to it from somebody else, maybe you're not going to get it because you've been inoculated or you've had it, which makes you immune, but can you carry it?
Not in the way that I think you're trying to suggest it. So individuals who you'd have to have an active infection to be able to actually be spreading it from one person to the next. If you have been vaccinated and your body is properly fighting off the infection, then you wouldn't be able to shed the virus to spread it to other people.
And Stephen, one of our listeners has sent us a question. Is measles something that adults need a booster for? I don't know when I got my measles shot. Maybe when I was 7, 5, 4. I don't know. Do I need a booster?
No, the general answer to that is no. Of course, if a person is immunocompromised, they might talk with their provider about any particular differences they might need. But generally speaking, no, adults do not need a booster if they've already been fully vaccinated.
We're on the verge in this country, I understand, of losing our designation as having wiped out the measles. Is that strictly because people are no longer getting the vaccines in enough numbers to give us essentially herd immunity?
That's certainly a part of it. I would say we've had more outbreaks, and actually large outbreaks, this year in this country than we have in recent history. That has basically caused our annual case count to go over the threshold for where we would be at, have that eradication designation. And I think as you've seen in South Carolina, as we've seen in Texas and other places, the majority of individuals who have been infected with the measles are folks who are not up to date on their measles vaccine. And so I would say, of course, that vaccination is certainly a part, or lack of vaccination is certainly a part of driving us to that place. The other reality is that measles does exist and is more prevalent in other countries. And we have open borders. People travel to other places to go visit, to go on vacation, to visit family. And so that reality for people who are, the more travel that's happening, the more activity and exchange does increase potential exposure, which is why it's particularly important if you are traveling to make sure you're up to date on all the vaccines for where you're going.
And I believe it was reported just yesterday of an exposure at an airport in Wake County. Not a case, but an exposure to the measles. Measles vaccinations, of course, can prevent these outbreaks. I believe health officials aim for 95% vaccination rates for measles. And in South Carolina, where they're experiencing a vaccination rate in Spartanburg County, the vaccination rate is at 90% or just below 90%. That's enough to make a difference?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it just, again, I think what we're seeing right now in most communities is that the individuals whose kids are not up to date on vaccines are actually concentrated in areas, in neighborhoods or communities or particular schools. And so that geographic concentration that we're seeing is really what's really creating an opportunity for these large outbreaks, because you have, in some of those areas, the vaccination rate is as low as, 50, 60%. And so you're creating a huge opportunity there for the virus to be able to spread. And look, the virus is just looking for a home, right? So the reality is that when we think about vaccination rates at the community level, 95% is that gold standard for where we would like to be. But even if when you start to get lower than that, you you have this geographic this geographic sort of disparity where you have more areas where you have more people unvaccinated, you create a perfect opportunity for an outbreak.
Measles, after the vaccinations became available, used to be rare. now, and they still are for the most part, except now we're beginning to see these outbreaks because of vaccine hesitancy and people who just don't believe in the vaccines anymore. And so people don't understand what measles do. Every child gets sick at some point in their life because they have to build up their immunity to all kinds of pathogens that come their way during their lifetimes. And these vaccines help them avoid getting sick from the measles. But if you get it, what's the big deal? You get the rash, you get the runny nose, you get the fever. Are there serious consequences to getting it in some people?
Absolutely, yeah. So, there are some children who, as we saw in Texas, there were multiple deaths connected to that outbreak. And so the risk of death is there. More severe consequences, more severe sort of morbidity is also there. Kids requiring hospitalization. Of course, that also equates to cost and time off from school and potential long-term health consequences. So there is a risk. Again, the majority of people do recover from measles, as you've described already, without any long-term effect. But there is not necessarily an equation to say who's going to have those more severe consequences. And so we want to avoid morbidity because you don't know who will ultimately get the sickest.
Cold weather also brings flu season. For some reason, viruses like to spread more often in the cold. We can talk about why, but do you know how many people in this area have received the flu vaccine so far?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have a great estimate of sort of folks who've received flu vaccines at this point in the year, but we typically have about 1/3 of our residents who get 30% to 33% of our residents who get the annual flu vaccine. We don't have an update right now of where we are for this year.
The health department, the state health department, Health and Human Services, has produced a respiratory dashboard, a virus dashboard, showing the number of emergency room visits by patients exhibiting symptoms of a respiratory virus, which the flu is. It goes back to January of this year, and the number of cases were the highest in February of this year, as you would imagine. That's usually the height of flu season. Those cases rose again slightly in September, and now they're on the rise again. Does the curve now, if you've had a chance to look at this dashboard, does it look substantially different from what was happening in December of last year?
I think we are certainly seeing flu activity is a little bit more delayed this year than what it was last year. I think we are, though I say that right now, but as I know that our respiratory viral rates are increasing pretty significantly. And so we are seeing increased activity here in Mecklenburg County in our emergency departments, as well as we know we have more cases of COVID-like illness as well. So as has happened typically after the holidays, Thanksgiving, people gather, we start to see that increase accelerate. And so we are seeing that now here in our community and also seeing an increase in hospitalizations for folks with flu, which likely is related to the severity of the flu disease that's circulating.
Yeah, shortly after this flu season began, new reports indicated that the shot that was developed for this year's flu was not completely effective for the strain that seems to have become dominant. And evidently, outbreaks of flu in our state presented early in October rather than January and were severe. What are the effects of, I think everybody's had the flu in their lives, but remind us, what are the severe effects of flu?
Well, it depends on who you are. I mean, so obviously the flu is, folks have pretty, the typical sort of respiratory viral symptoms, fever, cold, fever, chills, congestion. But also I think particularly for the more vulnerable folks in our community, our children, pregnant women, older adults, people who have underlying respiratory disease, certainly the flu can be highly, can cause lots of sickness and can also be fatal. We've had several flu deaths already in the state this year. So for folks who have underlying respiratory disease or are more medically fragile, the flu can present pretty severe consequences for those individuals and be tough to overcome.
I've read 9 adults in North Carolina have died so far of the flu this flu season. We have one case of a child dying from the virus. Is that average or above average? I have 10 seconds.
I think it's about on par for where we have been the last couple of years.
Okay. A little more conversation about the flu and other things going on in the medical world when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Raynard Washington. He's Mecklenburg County's Public Health Director, and we're talking about some of the things that might be going around that could spoil your holiday season if you should contract them. One of those things is the flu. Can you transmit the flu to somebody else if you don't know you have it, if you haven't gotten the fever and the chills that set in usually when you get a case of the flu?
Yeah, if you are shedding the virus, you can certainly transmit it to someone. It's usually people have symptoms pretty early on when they have a flu infection. But yes, once a person starts shedding the virus, they can certainly spread it to someone else.
So because it's a respiratory virus and it's found in droplets that you exhale, Deborah on Facebook wants to know, what do you think about the effectiveness of wearing masks during the holiday season? We all wore them for COVID. They became very political. The only people who wear masks today are Border Patrol agents. They'll be the healthiest people in America. So what is the effectiveness of wearing a mask?
That's not true, Mike. There are a lot of folks who wear masks. I think masks are effective tools to help, obviously, prevent the exchange of respiratory droplets between individuals. And so we certainly encourage folks who are immunocompromised or more medically vulnerable, particularly when they're in crowded places and spaces where there might be a lot of folks who might be coughing and sneezing, to consider wearing a face covering to protect against lower their risk of exposure compared to other folks.
If you get the flu, is it too late to get the shot? What, if anything, should you do at that stage?
Well, most folks who get the flu will be able to recover safely at home, but we always encourage folks to consult with their medical provider if they are having any severe symptoms. Certainly, individuals with any underlying health condition certainly might want to go in and see their provider. And so I would just say, in general, there are over-the-counter medications, and in the state, there is also an opportunity. Some pharmacies are now able to test for the flu and provide treatment as well if it's needed. So we do have, Tamiflu, which is a medication that we can use to treat the flu, but most people don't need it.
How does that work, Tamiflu?
It's an antiretroviral similar to other medications that basically work to suppress production of the virus and help the person's immune system fight the virus.
Does it relieve symptoms, or does it simply shorten your having to deal with that virus?
Yeah, it does a combination of both. Mike, it's not, everybody's body's a little bit different. Some people have will have symptom relief. Most people that have the flu are already on other medications that are addressing their symptoms. They usually are taking over-the-counter meds like, Dayquil and NyQuil. And so, it's sometimes hard to decipher exactly what's doing what, but in fact, it does help folks, keep their body from having severe consequences or severe damage being done to the respiratory tract and system.
I mentioned that with this recent outbreak of flu around the country, we discovered that the current flu shot is not necessarily as effective as they hoped it might be. And the reason for that is medical professionals have to guess every year at what will be the dominant strain and then develop the vaccine well in advance of that coming out. And sometimes the strain doesn't cooperate. Other vaccines are not like this. Why do we have to continue to do it this way? Why can't we develop a flu shot that combats whatever strain may present?
Yeah, you probably should ask that to an immunologist or someone who spends more time thinking about the virology of flu. But the reality is it's a very volatile virus. It is able to mutate very, very easily. And because of that, and because it is also spread so much, the more it spreads, the more opportunity the virus has to mutate. And because of that, we end up with varying strains circulating both here and across the globe. And so tailoring the vaccine to what we think is going to be the most dominant or predominant strains allows us to be more specific in our response, similar to what happens with COVID-19 as well. And you remember from the pandemic, as we talked about how easy it is for those viruses to mutate, those mutations, again, give the virus a better opportunity to thrive, which is what it's trying to do.
The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, was long considered to be the world's preeminent health facility, and it is no longer seen that way by many places around the world because of their mixed messages and incorrect information coming out of the CDC, particularly about vaccines and the like. And a number of state governors around the country have reacted to recent changes in policy at the CDC by having public health professionals in their own states counter some of the advice coming out of Washington. Those changes include reversing recommendations on vaccines, the ones out of Washington, that have been in place for decades, including, most recently, abandoning previous advice on having newborns receive the hepatitis B vaccine shortly after birth. What is your take on that?
Well, I think I would say this, that, you know, most of us have been very clear across the country, really speaking in unison about the realities that the hepatitis B vaccine at birth has had a significant impact on reducing both the risk and the rates of hepatitis B in our community. And so we have seen since the late 80s, early 90s, a huge reduction in hepatitis B burden since the start of us doing that, offering we're recommending vaccines at birth. And so I realize that the committee has, you know, made a decision that it's different. I think what you see is most of folks in public health and state leaders and even our pediatricians have been very clear, though, that the benefit of that vaccine at birth and the reality of what we see in our community in terms of not seeing the kind of hepatitis B in kids that we have seen previously, it works. And so I think the general consensus is that, you know, folks are going to continue to provide that option to families. And of course, we know our health insurance companies are going to continue to cover it. And so obviously state Medicaid is also continuing to cover it. And so that's sort of my thinking. You know, I think the reality is that hepatitis B incidence in adults is also increasing in our community, largely tied to the opioid epidemic. And so it's unfair to say that the risk of hepatitis B is not there, because we are seeing increases in adults in the community. And so and of course, more risk in adults means that more kids could potentially get it, both not just from you know, transmission from mother to baby, but also from exposure in the community.
So when average Americans, non-medical people, see these vast changes in policy and direction from the CDC, with advice now coming out that completely reverses what they recommended in the past, and when they see state governors setting up their own advisory panels that are issuing information and advice that conflicts with what the CDC is putting out, that puts all of us in the middle. We don't know what to do. So if that guidance, and perhaps different guidance, is coming from various states, what's the likely impact of that? And I ask because you have said that that advice could, quote, look different in almost every community, which is why federal policy is so important and shouldn't be changed with a keystroke.
Yeah, that's precisely, I mean, that's my perspective. The reality is that we could end up with recommendations that look different across every state. And if you move from state to state, there's a different recommendation or different expectation. And so those realities are troubling for all of us in public health. The reason why that we have federal partners to set federal standards is so that we have some level of consistency. As we've said about measles and pertussis and every other infectious disease, they don't know, or the disease doesn't know geographic boundaries, right? And so the reality is that most diseases are just looking for a host. And so we need that kind of leadership. Right now, as you mentioned, there's conflicting information. And so, not to mention, on top of different information from different governmental partners and entities, you've got all the noise that people are sort of, you know, pushing on social media and other places about conspiracy theories and people's interpretations of science and case studies. So I completely empathize with all of our residents about why it is difficult to know what to trust. But I think we are continuing to try to be as clear, concise, and focused in messaging, both at the local level as well as at the state level here, and are working with our provider community so that our doctors, our pediatricians, our OBs are prepared to respond to questions that family might have. But as I said in the interview you mentioned earlier, nothing drastic has changed in the science around hepatitis B, right? So this decision is really being driven by what I would consider political mischief more than it is being driven by the changes in science. And in fact, members of the committee themselves who did not vote for this acknowledged that that was a reality and that this change was going to cause harm in our country.
So is our is our health department, the Mecklenburg County Health Department, or our state department, health department, having to counter advice being doled out in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, we are. I mean, essentially, but our recommendations as a state and locally have not changed. And so there have not been any changes that have been made to the state guidelines or recommendations for childhood vaccines. And again, we here in Mecklenburg County do look to the state for our sort of legal recommendations.
So who do we believe? Tell me, as a person who knows nothing about any of this, you're the doctor. Why should I believe you, the local yokel, as opposed to the people in Washington, D.C.? I do mean that pejoratively, because that's how some people will see it.
Yeah.
So why should I believe you as opposed to somebody in Washington?
Well, I can say it this way. For sure, I don't have any political ties. I wasn't appointed by a politician. And my work here, I live in Mecklenburg County. I'm a neighbor of folks who live here. My commitment is to protecting and promoting health in this community for just that reason, so that we are a healthy community. And so,
But I mean, how do we separate the we know that a lot of this is politically motivated or ideologically motivated and not based in science. And it not only ignores the science, it gets the science wrong in many cases. So how do we as lay people separate ideology and politics from medical advice?
You know, it's getting harder, Mike. I mean, I don't have a sort of simple response to that. There's not an easy solution because what's happened in the last 11 months, I don't know what's to come in the future. I'm not sure how much more confusing it's going to be. I can assure you, though, that Mecklenburg County Public Health and our partners at the state, North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, are continuing to let science guide our decisions and recommendations. And we are here to answer questions that residents might have. And residents should feel free to ask questions. And that's why I'm here today. That's why we're going to be available to residents at schools and in our clinics and across the county to be able to answer questions. And that, I can assure you, how much more confusing things are going to get from the noise in Washington and Atlanta. I don't know. I can't say that. I don't have a crystal ball, but we're going to stay steadfast and continue to speak the truth and continue to speak against anything that we can't support with actual data.
Is this mismessaging, this inaccurate information coming out of the CDC and other places in Washington, is it already having an impact either here in Mecklenburg County, throughout the state, or around the country?
Well, I think even before this year, we have seen sort of vaccine hesitancy increasing with people, again, largely fueled by sort of, I would say, some of the organizations that were founded just to sort of sow vaccine hesitancy, organizations who were intended to sort of be pushing this as a parents' rights issue versus a public health and safety issue. And then it just sort of accelerated with now federal agencies being compromised in this way to add to that sort of narrative. And so, yes, we're continuing to see more families request exemptions for vaccines. And of course, as we see these outbreaks happening, we know that people aren't up to date to vaccine because we're having to follow up with families when they're exposed, their kids are exposed in schools. And so this is a pattern. I do want to, be clear, though, that the vast majority of residents in Mecklenburg County and across the state are continue to get their kids vaccinated and stay on schedule. There is a chunk of folks whose kids are not up to date on vaccines, not because they're opposed to them, but just because they haven't prioritized going to get them. And we work hard to make sure we bring vaccines to those folks so they.
In late November, the Mecklenburg County Health Department.
We can make it as easy as possible.
Oh, you broke up for a second. I thought you'd stop talking, but no, your connection stopped for a second. In late November, the Mecklenburg County Health Department reported on an increase in Mpox, monkeypox cases, and these cases are also rising elsewhere in the country. First of all, what is Mpox? How contagious is it? And what is the vaccination rate for it?
Sure. So Mpox, obviously we had an outbreak in 2022 when we first started having Mpox made its way to the U.S., and it is an infection that's spread via skin-to-skin contact. Most often that contact is during sexual activity, but it doesn't, not exclusively during sexual activity. You can contract it with skin-to-skin contact without being engaged in sexual activity. It is most commonly known for the lesions that are produced on the skin. We started to see an uptake in cases in October and November. We had largely had almost no cases up until that point this year. And so we put out a message that to encourage folks to get vaccinated. Largely, we have focused vaccine campaigns and efforts for Mpox on folks who are high risk. So individuals who have large numbers of multiple sexual partners, who engage in high-risk sexual activity. Those individuals have been the groups that we're focused on, and so we continue to make vaccine available here at the health department, again, at no cost, and folks who think they might be at risk are welcome to come in as well.
As everybody knows, recent operations conducted by Border Patrol here in Charlotte disrupted lives and businesses throughout the Hispanic community. Many people in that community depend on the health department to keep up with their treatments for TB and diabetes and other diseases and injuries. And the department reports a decrease in the number of women coming in for nutrition and breastfeeding support through WIC, the Women, Infants, and Children program. How disruptive was Operation Charlotte's Web in that sense, and have things returned to normal?
Yeah, that week, you know, was a tough week, I think, for us in terms of how we were able to, how we had to pivot to respond to our clients' needs. And so certainly we saw a reduction in individuals coming in for their appointments, an increase in no-shows. And particularly as it relates to tuberculosis control, of course, which those individuals have to come in more often to get their medications and be observed, we ended up having to pivot to provide some mobile care for folks who were concerned about coming into our facilities for a variety of reasons. And so it was a things have, I think, largely restabilized. We are still seeing some drop off in terms of our show rates for our clinics. But things are definitely better than they were that week that you're specifically talking about.
What if anything, did that operation do to trust between the Hispanic community and public health?
Well, I believe our community residents, didn't really impact our trust with them. We worked hard to make sure we were accessible and were able to pivot to residents and provide resources as much as possible during that time and make sure that people were still able to access their benefits by doing virtual appointments as well and making sure that, again, our TB patients had their medications for them. So, and in fact, I don't think it had a negative impact. It may have had a positive impact in some places, depending on who you ask.
So we have about 30 seconds left. We have measles going around. We have the flu going around. Of course, common colds are always with us. There are other things going around in the cold months. And we have holiday gatherings in our recent past for Thanksgiving and coming up in the recent future for Christmas and New Year's. What tips do you have for staying healthy and for not spreading whatever it is you got to other people?
Well, you're probably going to guess my most important, only tip I need to say is if you don't feel well, you should stay home. That is the thing that helps us keep folks well, is other folks who are sick not being around other people. So first off, if you have symptoms of a respiratory virus, you should probably stay away from other people or just slip on one of those masks or a face covering to help reduce the risk.
Dr. Maynard Washington, Mecklenburg County Public Health Director, always good to see you. Thank you for the information. We appreciate it.
Yep, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. When we come back, we'll talk about how to deal with stress and depression and other things that may affect your mental outlook during the holidays. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Holidays are promoted as times of joy, and for most of us, they are, but this time of year can also increase stress and bring on the blues. Are there ways to minimize that stress that can spoil the season for you? How do you spot depression in yourself and others, and how do you help minimize those feelings? For answers, we turn now to Felice Hightower-Britt. She is a licensed clinical mental health counselor, certified life coach, and certified clinical trauma professional in private practice at Resiliency Therapeutic Services. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. At this time of year, we are surrounded by celebrations, ubiquitous holiday music, which tells us repeatedly this is the most wonderful time of the year. But that is not the case for everybody. And this year, with rising prices causing already stretched budgets to stretch even more to the point where you may not be able to participate the way you would like, could this end up not being a wonderful time for more people than usual?
Always, and for various reasons, right? It could be due to, you know, people have had a loss, whether it was through death, a relationship, a job, which a lot of people have experienced job loss, which has affected their finances. And so it's different reasons why people may not feel that this is the joyous part of the year for them, and rightfully so. And that's okay. And that's what people have to bring.
And when you're bringing that into the holiday season, whether it's acute or chronic, does the holiday season, because we are bombarded with images of telling us we ought to be happy, does that exacerbate the situation?
It can. And, you know, it's so commercialized, right, Mike? Like, it starts in July now with the messaging.
We're going to have red and green fireworks.
So in July, the pressure starts, you know what I mean? And so it's so, we really have to, we have to fight back and say, no, no, no. Like, let everything come organically the way it really is supposed to be, so that we don't start building people's anxiety around having to be joyful, having to be happy. You know, you start people's depression a whole lot earlier, because in July they start thinking about, well, you know, I lost my mom and she's not going to be with me. You know, instead of just having the holiday show up like it normally would, and then, you know, maybe the sadness, which is natural, right? You know, grief, there's no real time frame to grief. There's no real time frame to when you have memories of a loss, but we can exacerbate it about all the bombarding and the marketing that comes with it. And so, I don't know, I would really love for us to start a campaign that says, no, we are not gonna start talking about Christmas in July. You know, we're not gonna watch the Hallmark films,
well,
no.
You bring up an interesting point, because that is driven by marketing and commercialism, certainly. But also, we've bought into this. December the 25th, the morning of December the 25th, to be specific, has become a highly anticipated moment since our childhood. That's when we come downstairs in our jammies, and there are all these presents under the tree, and we can't wait to tear into them. Then it's over.
Yeah.
So this big anticipatory event has taken place in the blink of an eye, and then it's over. What's the effect on your mental state of that? Because it can hit you like a ton of bricks.
You know, but, you know, if you think about all the anticipatory things that we create, right? Like wedding days, you know, all of that, like all of that in a day, it's over. So what we have to do is we really have to pace ourselves and prioritize our values, right? So what does that mean? I'll give you an example of what I did, because, you know, growing up, I really didn't enjoy when Christmas came up, because I didn't grow up with a lot, right? And so I didn't look forward to Christmas like everybody else did. So when I became a parent, what I did was I prioritized my value with Christmas. And so I would tell my daughter, you're going to pick one good gift, that's it. And told her the meaning of Christmas. It's not necessarily about us and getting gifts, but it's also about giving to others, making sure that other people have feel welcomed and that they feel loved during this time of year and the day after. It's not just the day, but the day after, when everything, all the plates are put back up. And so what happened? My daughter cherished every gift she ever had, and she probably still has them, because it wasn't about rushing down to the tree for all these gifts and toys that no one's going to remember or play with after an hour. You're absolutely right. And so you have to think about your values, and you have to find the real meaning in the holiday in order to make it reasonable and doable and what it was really meant for. I don't think that Christmas was meant for people to just rush down and just have this huge moment and then it's over with. I don't think that was the original intent.
Let's talk about something else that seems to be exacerbated by the holidays, because a lot of people are alone in the world today. The American Psychological Association reported in 2023 that 70% of Americans felt some degree of loneliness as the holidays approached, and more than 10% felt lonely in a major way. Why?
So honestly, it's not just Christmas anymore. Like, for whatever reason, people are the loneliest as they've ever been. And I'm gonna tell you what I think it is. I think it is social media. I think that the pandemic really did us a disservice. It also trained us to be indoors and isolate. And so for those 2 years, that was just enough time for people to now struggle with coming back out, struggle with fellowshipping. People are socially awkward. They overthink everything. They really don't feel comfortable in settings. And so you on the scroll, you know, you're constantly scrolling, comparing yourself. And so you feel as if you're missing something, that your life is not what it really should be. And you come up with all of this misinformation that makes you feel more isolated, more alone than you ever were. And it is not factual. It is really all in your mind, but people feel so lonely. And even people who are married in relationships go out. People just say and believe that they're lonely. But during the holidays, you really believe that during the holidays, it's supposed to be family, fun, friends, warmth, joy, happiness. And so if you don't feel that way, you feel as if you're lonely and nobody understands what you're going through.
This predates the pandemic. There's a lot of this that is the result of the pandemic and social media. But we used to hear people say that even in a crowd, they felt alone. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, absolutely. And honestly, you know, and I'm not trying to get too deep, but we have to make peace with this. The reason why that is because we are unique. There is no one who is like me on the planet. There is no one who can really identify with my walk, my journey. I do that in and of myself. And so that makes me a little lonely, right? Because there's nobody who can really identify with my journey. It is mine and mine alone. So I am of the premise that you have to make peace and be okay with you, being with you, whether you're in a crowd or alone, that you are enough. And how do you make peace with that, right? And not look at being alone versus lonely as such a negative thing.
So if you are lonely because you are in fact alone, or if you are lonely because of all the things you've just talked about, even though you have a partner or a family or you're at holiday gatherings, is it best to put yourself in those social situations? Put yourself, take yourself to that party, even though you feel alone in a crowd. Is it best to do that, or is it best to sit at home with a bowl of popcorn and watch TV?
I think that it is best to put yourself in those social settings, right? Socialization is a skill and it must be practiced. And so when you push yourself to get out there, you start to realize, oh my gosh, I was really in my head about everything, right? Like I was in my head. But when I forced myself to get in there with people in the fellowship, you start to realize, oh my gosh, we're all alike. We're having a good time. It's really not all that. Like you have to really, you kind of have to push yourself to get out there. And we were created for fellowship, Mike.
Yeah, we are social creatures. And this is kind of off the topic of holidays, but it so permeates our culture now. I think it's valuable to talk about this now. There are a lot of people who spend all of their time on social media, and they think that they're making connections with other people on social media. But there's still these feelings of loneliness and isolation. What's the difference if you're having these conversations on social media with others as opposed to being in person face to face?
And so how can we break it down? So a lot of I've got over 2,000 friends on my Facebook page.
Oh my God.
I do not have 2,000 friends. I don't. I mean, and to be honest, I probably got 3 good ones. You know what I mean? So it's like it's all an illusion. It's not real. It's not factual. And there's something intrinsic about us that knows that, you know what I mean? And so that's the rub, is that you really don't have 2,000 friends. They really can't relate to you. You can't really reach out to them tangibly to help you pay a bill, to help you have a coffee. You know, it's, and we really know that, and then we don't. And that's the rub. And so.
And a like on social media is not a connection. It's
not a connection. And it's so flawed and it's so flaky, right? Like one day they like your lipstick, and then the next day they're like, oh my gosh, what'd she do that for? Can you imagine what that does to the psyche?
Yeah.
You know, and then you looking and gravitating for that like and that validation that is so flaky and inauthentic.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk about another key ingredient of the holidays, and that is stress. This is a stressful time of year. Even if you're in the best of mental health and you love the holidays and you love the gatherings and you can't wait to see grandma, it's stressful. There's so much to do, so much to plan for, and for many, the need to really carefully budget, because everything costs more money. The food for the table, the gift to under the tree, etc. And all of that, all of these things that we have to do are on top of what we must do to live our normal lives. What do you recommend to people to relieve some of that stress?
So let it go. It doesn't have to be stressful. It really doesn't. And be more community focused. Like, why do you have to be the only one to prepare for everything? So if people are coming to your home, instead of you cooking everything, ask everybody to bring a dish, right? Make it communal. It doesn't all have to land on you. And it is a mindset. It does not have to be stressful. You really can have a wonderful time even as the host. And it's mostly the people who are hosting that feel the most stressed. But put boundaries around everything. Let everybody know, hey, come in your PJs, come as you are. We're just going to have a good time, and stop trying to be perfect in it, right? There's this level of perfection and that everything has to be just right. How about just being, just showing up, being everybody giving a helping hand and everybody being reasonable. So instead of just buying all these, me and my family, what we did, we got on this app that allows you to pick a name, and that's the only person that you buy a gift for. They give you their gift list. And that's the person you buy for. Everybody gets something, but you're not responsible for buying all the gifts for everyone. How budget friendly is that? It takes the load off of you.
Yeah, it allows you to save some money, budget wisely, not be in debt after the holidays, and still not feel like Ebenezer Scrooge, I guess.
Right.
And then there is the stress of family. Not everybody gets along with everybody in their family, even the people that they grew up with, and certainly not their in-laws. There are comedians have made a living talking about in-laws. Every family also has this odd duck of an aunt or uncle who says things that just set your teeth on edge. So what's the best way of getting through that, of dealing with those situations?
So if you're open to it, boundaries, like you have to tell the aunt who has no filter, look, we need you to watch what you say. If you can't, we've got this great TV room for you to go watch a nice Netflix movie. So you can say. or you can just ignore it, like have an understanding. There's a reason that people show up the way that they do. And when you go on and when you go in and you mentally prepare and you know, okay, that's Aunt Susie. We're not going to let her get to us. Do your breathing. Okay. Deep breathe through everything before you think you want to respond or you want to get irritated. Take a deep breath and actually let your body do a reset. Right. And just determine and affirm, I'm going to have a good time in spite of Auntie or in spite of Uncle Joe. Like, I'm determined to have a good time and spread love and spread joy.
Our expectations are set by commercial entities who want us to spend money. They're also set by the media, and we have to remember and remind ourselves that holiday time, Christmas, whatever it may be, Hanukkah, is not like the Hallmark holiday movies, and it's just not realistic. NPR recently reported on various aspects of the challenges we face at this time of year and came to this conclusion. If the holidays are stressing you out, remember, everything is optional, which is something you just said. So I have about a minute left. If you face any of these things that we've been talking with, or whether it's feeling overwhelmed or stressed out or depressed before, during, and after the holidays, when do you know you need to seek professional help? And when it comes to depression, how can you spot it in others if it's severe enough for them to need that help? I have about 30 seconds.
Right, so extreme sadness, loss of interest with others or their hobbies, excessive sleep and or appetite or lack thereof, difficulty at work, concentrating, performance, irritable, restless, easily frustrated. If that lasts more than 2 weeks, see either your primary care physician, do your job EAP, and or if it's really bad, like self-harming thoughts, go to your local emergency department.
Felice Hightower-Britt is a licensed clinical mental health counselor, certified life coach, certified clinical trauma professional, and in private practice at Resiliency Therapeutic Services. Thanks for the hour. De-stress. Have a happy holiday.
Thank you. You too. Happy holidays.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.